I would like to acknowledge the Guringai people and pay my respects to the elders both past and present. The Guringai people are the traditional owners of this land where we meet today. Navigating the worlds of creativity, leadership, and family isn't always easy. My guest, Kelly Van Nelson, seamlessly manages her roles as an author, poet, executive leader, wife, and mother. We'll talk about her early years growing up in a council flat in Newcastle upon Tyne and leaving home as a teenager to begin working. Kelly will share her strategies for time management, maintaining creativity amidst a demanding career, and finding inspiration in the midst of daily life. And yes, there have been challenges and lessons she has learned along the way to enable her to be successful. Get ready as we unravel Kelly's secret to the ultimate balancing act as we look at her juggling mastery.
Welcome to Sharing Stories, Changing Lives. The host, Karen Sander, has the privilege of interviewing individuals from all walks of life, each with their own powerful and inspiring stories. The guests share their life experiences, and in doing so, they celebrate the transformative magic of storytelling. To learn more, visit www.thestoryroom.au and explore the private membership area, the Backstage Pass.
Welcome, Kelly, to Sharing Stories, Changing Lives.
Hi, Karen. Good to talk to you.
Great. I know you're in the UK working at the moment, and I'm back here in Australia, but I thought it was a great opportunity to get you online. Well, you were born in the UK, so can you tell us a little bit about your early years in Newcastle upon Tyne, I believe, and what prompted you as a teenager to move on?
Yeah, I was born in Newcastle and lived there until I was in my late teens, sort of 17, 18. And I lived in a council estate my mum remarried, and we had a sort of a pretty challenging household and pretty challenging school life, actually, with high school. But I have some very good friends back in Newcastle, and I visit a lot and enjoy getting back there to see my sister there. Still absolutely a Geordie, and was very fond recollections of going to the football at St James's Park and spending my Saturdays doing that. But I would definitely have to sort of prefix childhood with challenges. To be honest, it was a pretty tough upbringing.
Do you think this experience as a child and a teenager growing up in Newcastle in a council estate, and did that experience, how did it really shape you?
At night, I would probably say I struggled to go to sleep. So I was a huge insomniac, mainly because there was often rows in the household. There was always a lot of noise, and I would try and tune it out and sort of escape reality of what was going on in and around the household. With rows and things happening. So I would read, and I would read under the duvet with a torch until 2, 3am, and I would write, and I would sort of try and escape the reality of life, to be honest, and block out the noise that way as best I could by this sort of tent I created under the duvet. And I learned to do that. I learned to, you know, block things out and sort of then just refocus the mind in different ways to do that, and I've carried a lot of those skills forward. I would say I can focus quite well despite everything in the madness going on around, you know, that might be going on in the environment around me. And I probably developed an early resilience as a child that is serving me well through my later years. I would definitely say it's my sort of superpower. It would be resilience for sure.
Because as soon as you said you were able to box things out, wouldn't that be great for me? You know, I'd love to be able to compartmentalize things. Unfortunately, I can't, and my mind at times goes like on 50 different projects at the same time. But that is a real superpower.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I could do it at school as well, but school was the school that I went to when I was a young girl was in the lowest 5% of demographics, actually, in Newcastle, in terms of lowest socioeconomic groups and just deprived poverty. To be frank, it was in the lowest 5% in the country. It got closed. It's actually been closed now, which is a real shame. And even at school, there was always dramas going on and a lot of kind of nonsense going on and sometimes trouble in and around the school. And I could still focus on my lessons. I could tune out and become invisible and, you know, just ignore everything. I definitely have developed an ability to just keep the focus, keep the mind on the job, and stay true to what I'm trying to do and the resilience there. Yeah, I learned it through home and school, to be honest, probably at a pretty young age.
You should bottle it.
Yeah.
That could be a great product.
It would sell just as good as wine, maybe, hey, or maybe not.
I think that we could go into a business partnership, how to bottle and compartmentalize your life. You know, that would, I think a lot of people would love to do that, especially those of us that are insomniacs. Mm. And turning it all off, shutting the lid on these boxes every night and going, that's it, guys, you're locked away. Exactly. Can you share a bit about your background in the journey to being a writer, a poet, an author, an executive leader and wife and mother, because that is huge.
That's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yes.
It absolutely is. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what came first, but probably the writing came first. So if I was to ask my two best friends from the school days, they would say that when I was 13 or so, you know, 13, maybe 14, that I would often say to them, one day I'm going to write a book. And I think that definitely came from the love of reading and the love of words and, you know, the freedom of imagination that the literary world brings. So I definitely at a young age wanted to write a book, and I can't remember ever not wanting to do that. So it was like an early ambition that I had as a child, and I never doubted I would do it. I always knew I would do it somehow as a young teenager. So I have been writing since quite young, and I've continued it, to be honest. I write almost every day something, but I got serious about it probably in my 20s, where I started trying to, you know, get stuff into some magazines and competitions, and, you know, you're trying to get, you know, just get a little bit of work out there, see if it's got any merit. I was probably in my late 20s, maybe, I think, that I had a poem published in an online literary in a published print anthology in the UK, which was a poem about mining in Newcastle, and I still do that poem today. Yeah, that was the first break, and I thought, oh yeah, okay, some of this stuff might not be too bad, and I just kept going, to be honest, and I started developing bigger pieces and short stories and you know, into longer full length fiction, novel length pieces. And it just got bigger and bigger. So, yeah, eventually that morphed into full writing. And I've had 7 books published, which is pretty cool. 3 which are poetry, which are short and sharp, and the others, which are different genres. But all of them with a social purpose around socioeconomics and, you know, troubled backgrounds, the underbelly of life, and just the sort of stark raw truth of day-to-day living. No frills. And I love that writing style, and I do love to write about the underdog. So writing definitely came first. I would then say corporate was not long after. So I left Newcastle. I always wanted to and knew I would, and I knew I could carve a better life, and I didn't want to settle for the status quo of childhood and what was ahead if I stayed. So I packed up, got a one-way ticket to London, and I got eventually into the corporate world through putting myself through night school. And I've loved it ever since. And I've just really learned to progress, you know, up the corporate ladder. I'm a senior executive now in a big global firm, hence working in the UK. Actually, I'm on a secondment here. I normally do live in Sydney, but I'm seconded here at the moment in the defence industry. But I've just worked my way up, to be honest, through learning and through adapting and taking the opportunities as they're given. And then the last bit, yeah, I am a mum. I'm a mum of two. I've got two beautiful kids who are 18 and 20, and one is quite creative and the other is an absolute whiz at science and maths and all the things I'm not a whiz at. But they're great kids. And my husband is as well. I've been married 27 years, I think, 27, 28 years, a long time anyway. And yeah, I've got a beautiful family as well. So it is a little bit crazy at times balancing all of that.
You actually have plenty of fodder for your poetry and your stories from your early life and all the things that you're doing now. But I think some of the best writers have come from real hardship. You know, it doesn't come from having an easy life quite often, because it's, to me, life experiences give you that fodder that you need to be able to write. You know, not in all cases, but that's I think for a lot of people, that's what happens. I just want to mention your TED talk at the moment, because that is a lot about your juggling of life and being a wife and a mother and a writer and an executive in the world in business. So can you give us the title of your TED talk in case someone's interested in listening?
Yeah, the TED talk I did in the middle of COVID, actually, which was interesting in itself. The name of my talk is Abandoned Superwoman on Krypton. And it is exactly what you said there. It's about blending life as a mum, as a poet, and as a corporate executive, and blending those three areas and aspects of life into one authentic self. And yeah, it was meant to be on stage. It got very rapidly at the 20th hour put onto a live stream and beamed out that way because of the COVID barriers on the borders and everything with filming. But I loved it. It definitely stretched things, and I had to write a longer piece than what I often do in slam poetry. So it's 12 minutes long, and it is online on TED if people want to go and have a look for it. But it definitely reflects, you know, what we've just been chatting about there, about just blending life and finding ways to juggle all of those different things that are going on any given day.
I love listening to you slam, because that's a treat in itself. And to slam such a long poem without a hitch is absolutely incredible. And it's quite unlike other TED Talks, because you are telling your TED story through poetry. Your creativity has to often take a back seat with your schedules. How do you maintain your creativity while you've got all these demands on you with career and family?
It can get quite tough, because especially with the corporate world, the schedule goes up and down, and there are peaks and troughs, and it can get pretty crazy with things going on. But what I've learned over the years, and it took me quite a long time to do it, is for years I was trying to be those three different aspects of life, being a mum and being a poet and working in the corporate world. I was trying to sort of keep them separate in their own little zones, if you like, or worlds or universes. And they didn't really cross. So, you know, I would go to work, I'd do my corporate job, and then I'd go home and I'd write before bed, and then I'd spend time with the family, and they would be quite separate, you know, identities almost. And I had some business coaching about it not that long ago. I'm probably talking 5 or 6 years ago or thereabouts, and the business coach, the number one thing they tried to coach me was let down the barriers between your three areas of, you know, family work and creativity, and drop those different segmenting walls, and allow yourself to be one person and manage your time, you know, across the three as you need to, and let them merge and let them blend and let them get murky, and embrace your full authentic self as one whole, you know, sort of, you know, one whole person. And I've embraced that ever since. It took a while, to be honest, because nobody at the time as well. I hadn't had any books published. My first book was published in 2019, and the coaching was before that book came out. And then the book came out, and I was, okay, everybody knows I'm a writer now anyway, so I might as well get on with it. And people in the corporate world never really knew I was writing and was doing this slam poetry scene. And, you know, so that was an interesting little period, and definitely felt a bit uncomfortable at first. And then I started doing events. I did Story Room in Sydney, you know, which you host. And I
yeah, one of mine.
Exactly. And that's live, and it puts you out of comfort zone. And it is an example of just letting down the barriers. And then, you know, people just gradually got to know, okay, I'm a poet and a corporate person, and they don't look or seem like they might coexist, but of course they can. So yeah, that was kind of a definite pivotal moment. I was running in parallel to myself, actually, and it's pretty tiring to do that. And now I don't bother. So it's one whole person, and I apply my time and my focus and priorities as I see fit on any given day, and it varies from day to day.
In the corporate world, people, the leadership teams, et cetera, and your colleagues at work, they all see you or see everyone as they have a family as well. They don't see that as two separate things. And in some companies, they sort of say, well, yeah, family comes first, but you have to, you know, because that makes people happy. And if you're unhappy at home and trying to juggle that part of life, you bring that to work. It makes sense what you're saying, that this is part of who you are, that creativity possibly helps you a lot with the work that you do.
Yeah, it definitely does. The creative side is a way to sort of almost switch off from some of the stuff that might be going on in the corporate world. And I work in some quite complex environments, supporting government in different areas. So the creativity piece I find is a way to just tune out a little bit. I can de-stress with it. I can get in a completely different, you know, sort of part of the brain and be quite free with what I'm cooking up in there. And with the family, I always put them first, whether I'm at home or whether I'm away, and I work away a lot. This stint in the UK, this secondment, was supposed to be 2 weeks. It's ended up being a year and a quarter. And I've rolled with that, but made absolute time to try and, you know, navigate what that means for me and my husband and kids, and the travel commitments, you know, to make sure we don't go too long without seeing each other, and using, you know, the technology and video streaming and calling each other about small things, big things. Mm. I've never really felt that the family go on a back burner, even when it's particularly manic or particularly intense. I'm in an environment where it's harder to communicate or you know, be around. I've found ways to bridge that, and that's worked really well. But I love the creativity. I think I would actually probably stress out more at work if I didn't have that creative part. So people often go, how can you write 7 books? How have you got the time when you work full time in a senior role? That's sort of 120% on the go most days. But it's my zone to just allow myself to be at peace and just let the brain work however it wants without any boundaries, and all kinds of weird and wonderful things often fall out of that.
Your poetry is quite incredible, but I think too, just jumping back a bit to talk about juggling with your family and your whole business, et cetera, and family being first, that it does also take a team at home who, you support them, but they support you as well. I know your husband steps in when you're not around, and you know, he's probably the primary carer when you're at such a distance across the world.
Yeah, I mean, he's amazing. I'm super lucky. I've got such amazing kids and a husband who's super supportive. He always has been of the career of writing and of what's going on in life. And We both, I think, I could probably look back the last 20 years or something, and one of us usually has been in a job that takes us away a fair bit. My husband did fly in, fly out for years in and around the mining industry and resource sector and oil and gas. His job way back in the day, I'm going back to, you know, 25 years, he was a fireman working a lot of night shifts, and that's not been the case generally. My job's been, you know, full on with the traveller. I spent a year in Adelaide not long before I got deployed to the UK, and this particular work assignment has meant a longer period here on the opposite side of the world to the family. But every time we've just got on with it, whether it's been his job, whether it's been my job, we've got like just this dual respect for each other, and the one supports the other. We get on with the house, and, you know, it can get a little bit tough sometimes when you're on your own, but we've learned to just crack on and do what we can, you know, from a distance, do what we can from home. The kids are really great, you know, so that goes a long way. But I've got a super husband. I'm very lucky.
You've obviously earned that trust with each other and built that trust that it works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you have to, don't you? I think if you're married 20 odd years, you've got to just trust one another and get on with it, and, you know, and cut each other a break if, you know, things are not perfect each day. and you know, life's got bumps and ups and downs and everything. But yeah, we've never had sort of concerns if one's away, either way, whether he's worked away, whether I've worked away. It's part of the careers, and I definitely see now. I mean, I work in, as I say, in a large global company. We've got a huge workforce, and more we're seeing you know, people coming into business these days that, you know, both sides of a partnership are in careers, and you know, we've got equal footing in the employment world, whatever that looks like. You know, it's not, I think, long gone are the days where the male would work if mum's at home. You know, I think it's just a much more equal society now, where you've got all kinds of different blended families and circumstances. But we just get on with it. We don't fight about it. We embrace the opportunity it brings as well. My husband just came over to the UK, and we nipped off to Venice for New Year, and you just make the most of it. And it's actually it's really worked for us.
That's exactly right.
You know, you can be apart for 12 weeks and then have another honeymoon, you know, so there's always a positive. Always, I'm definitely a glass half full.
Kelly, will you share one of your poems with us, please?
Let's do a little short one, maybe about, it's not so much about creativity, but it maybe fits with the conversation we just had around, you know, sometimes being alone, sometimes just needing to get on with things and just being comfortable with everything going on in and around you. So I might do this little short one, which is called The Edge. My feet walk the knife's edge, as in the past I made a pledge to seek not a new limit, but to discover my already existent hidden capabilities wedged in my brain that, unless stretched, will never reign in its true potential, leaving me stuck in consequential thought restriction and sequential penitential regret. My ego seeks not affirmation, for lack of humility is damnation, and I found peace in gratitude for all I am when embracing solitude inside the comfort of my own skin, where I don't need attestation from him or her or them or you to know I'm worthy of being true to myself and accepting of the knowledge that I am unique, so people can take any critique elsewhere, for I am me.
These are a lot of the things that you've learned along the way, to love yourself and that you are unique. And many people, Kelly, they're searching outside themselves for validation and looking for answers. But when you go in, which I believe this is what you're talking about in that poem, that's where you find
it. Yeah, that's exactly right. You've just got to find your own peace, haven't you, and what works inside for yourself. And you've absolutely got to dovetail it with your family and all the things that go on with your family dynamics, and everyone's circumstances are different. But you've definitely got to look after yourself a little bit and your own, you know, mental health and well-being and joy and happiness. And if you do it, it fully rubs off on your family. I definitely find if you're a positive person, it runs off, you know, rubs off on the family. If you're at peace with yourself and you can be independent, you know, that can rub off on the family. And I often will say to my daughter, we talk about this a lot, me and my daughter. It's one of our favorite topics. We'll talk about power that it brings you. If you've just got independence, you can be on your own, you can be anywhere, anytime, and you can look after yourself and be comfortable in your own skin. She went off to camp not long ago, a school camp, and she wrote something in a letter, and I won't share the whole letter, but about that being some real words of wisdom that she will always remember, about just, you know, being okay with your own self, and you don't have to rely on other people to feel validated and, you know, worthy and all of those things. You can find that in yourself, and that will then rub off on your family and others and translate into, you know, happiness and love and, you know, a really fulfilling family home, which I didn't have as a kid, you know. So it was literally the opposite at home as a kid. So it's not that I've worked hard at it or anything, but I've chosen a partner that, you know, I do trust, and he's a brilliant father and man, and raised my kids to value independence and their own self-respect and to figure out what their goals are and dreams and go for them and live life to the fullest.
Just relate back to some of the early conversation about you didn't want to stay in Newcastle because you didn't want to live that life, because you could see what life was going to be like if you did stay?
If you're interested in getting more involved in our community, connecting with people who share your interests, you can do this by visiting our website at www.thestoryroom.au.
Example, if you're in a family that is always yelling and screaming at you each other, then 9 times out of 10, you're going to grow up and build another family that's always screaming at each other. And I think you walking away from that and learning other ways has been probably your saviour.
It can become a product of environment and of, you know, parenting and of, you know, upbringing, and all those things form part of your DNA. And I think I've got some of the scars from childhood. I've got some of the strengths from childhood. But there does come a point, no matter what is going on around you, that you get to make your own decisions, rightly or wrongly. You know, and it comes from a young age, right and wrong, and whether you do the right thing or you don't do the right thing. So I definitely made that choice, to be honest. I made a huge conscious choice in my teenage years that I wasn't going to stay, that I wanted more from life, and, you know, wanted to set out on a completely different path. And that was kind of the ambition, to be honest. The ambition as a youngster was, I want to write a book eventually one day, but I do want to leave Newcastle and go and find, you know, life and explore the world and explore, you know, travel and food and people and what is out there, and to try and become the best that I could be in my own self, and do myself as proud as I could in my own self. I love going back to Newcastle, so it's not that I have any dislike for Newcastle. I go back a lot, actually. My sister's there. We always go out on the town, and we always have a nice meal and a good chat and a good good wander around the city. And I have a deep love for home in that respect, and Newcastle will always be my childhood home. Everything else that I left behind, I have no regrets. And if I'd stayed, I would have been a completely different person, and I have no regrets for walking away.
Finding inspiration in daily life can often be challenging, but is there an instant where you discovered inspiration in an unexpected place or some place you were and you found inspiration?
I do this all the time, so I can't give you even a massive example. I find inspiration in the often uninspiring things. So, you know, it might be a fluorescent light, it might be a brick wall that has been crumbling away or has been sprayed with street art, you know, with a mural. I find beauty in chewing gum in the cracks in the pavement. That will give me spin off into a poem around, you know, about that particular sort of inanimate object. I love beauty in, you know, the underbelly of life, and just the day-to-day stuff that people walk past and don't even see, you know, and that can be in the concrete jungle, it can be in the middle of the countryside or by the beach, it doesn't matter. But I love to look for the unexpected beauty or the beauty that people just take for granted or just don't see and are blind to. So, yeah, I like the rawness of the gritty side of life. Absolutely. That would be probably one of the biggest sort of, you know, inspirations in everything that I write. I write the urban side of life.
Do you think you see things as you're out and about that other people may not see?
Yeah, I don't know if people don't see it or it doesn't register, perhaps. I actually sometimes intentionally when I'm walking along the street, I will stop and I'll look down, you know, what looks to be, you know, a little side alley with dustbins, you know, parked there, and rubbish might be spilling out and whatever. And I go, okay, that's just life. It's part of life. And somebody is working in that, you know, back street alley and bringing that out. What are they doing? So the brain, it can, an unusual thing can just stem a story or can stem a circumstance or can make me wonder what's really going on there. So, yeah, I don't know if it's just a different part of the creative brain that I really love more urban side of things. Underbelly of life. And it definitely sort of prods creative thinking. I have loads of poems about stuff that are just weird and wonderful, either objects or settings or nothing in particular.
Is there anything in particular that you want to add to time management?
I mean, if I think about the corporate job in particular, you know, I wouldn't have a job, I think, if I sat all day writing poems at the desk and did that for 10 hours of the working day. Even though I say, you know, I've blended the whole world, that's not what's kind of happening. I am absolutely committed and focused to my, you know, full working commitments and some, and therefore have to prioritise, because I've got some, you know, I've often got major deadlines, I've got a major piece of work I'm on, and there are commitments that I have to bring into the working, the workplace and the job. So I have some practical ones. I've got some impractical ones that just serve me well. But some practical ones would be definitely to carve out a little bit of time in your working week to allow your corporate brain to work as well, and not be caught up on action, action, action. What's next on the to-do list? What's the next meeting? You know, and booking in the meetings back to back all day long with no break. And by the end of the day, you're absolutely frazzled. And, you know, you've barely taken a bathroom break or, you know, a lunch break or anything like that, and given yourself time to just breathe and think. And I operated like that for years. I have quite a fast-paced style. I run, you know, 150 miles an hour most days and thrive in sort of working under pressure. I've always got something going on, you know, whether it's a book, you know, manuscript bubbling away or whatever, or something at work. And I like, you know, life that's quite fast paced, and I've probably, you know, created a bit of that for myself. But more and more increasingly in the last few years, I've been being coached actually as well at work on trying to work at 90% like that, which is not my normal speed of work, and to allow the other 10% to think more strategically and big picture, and to just have wellness moments where I am taking a, you know, a 10-minute break between meetings. So often my diary now, I often have 15-minute gaps. I'll book a 45-minute meeting and then a 15-minute gap. I encourage the team to do the same. And that's helpful because people can say usually in 45 minutes what they might, you know, drag out for 60 minutes to say. So people get more succinct and more focused about meetings and things like that. So that's a really practical tip. But I have got other things like that where I prioritise. I do what people call eat the frog. So I'll get up in the morning, I will switch on, and I will, I don't know if you know the eat the frog phrase, but...
No, I don't.
Yeah, I mean, it's a phrase where you're basically getting up in the morning and you are doing the worst possible tasks that you don't want to do and get them out the way first. And then the rest of your day is more enjoyable and free of that thing that has been sitting there. So it's just an eat the frog. That I literally have like a 20 second poem on this, which is called Eat the Frog, and it's hop onto to-do list, bright eyes bulging, no time to relax, croaking on lily pad, soaked in slimy denial, pretend it's another poison until finally the time comes round to swallow excuses and eat the frog. I know it's a daft little poem, but it's just eat the bad task, get it out of the way, and your whole day is like a better day, like a more positive day. It's not dwelling, oh, I need to do that, I need to do that, I need to do that. Yeah, so I definitely try and frog in the morning. I get up and I start the day, get that done, and then my day's better. I don't know if that's practical or that's just one of my little creative things that I do, but I
Well, it is practical. Some people, you know, it's a bit like procrastination, isn't it, that you can... something that you're procrastinating over keeps going over and over in your mind and clogging up the brain cells and wasting your time thinking about it. So I guess eat the frog like that. It gets it out of the way. You've done it. You can forget about it. Yeah. I'm going to eat more frogs.
And the flip side of that as well, if you've got, you know, whether it's a massive dream, you know, and a big ambition in life, or a small goal that you know, you've got for the day or the year or whatever it is, I try and take a baby step a day towards that. So again, it might be a tiny thing, a tiny, tiny thing, which is just, I'm going to sit for 5 minutes and just think about achieving that particular thing. Or it might be, I'm going to write a 3-line Japanese haiku, which is, you know, can be a 2-minute job, and just see what pops out. But it's a step towards a poetry book or something like that. So I eat the frog in the morning and I try and take one baby step towards either a short-term goal or a long-term goal each day. And you find yourself able to, you know, really start kicking some of the ambitions into reality. And it's not that you're going to spend your whole life dreaming, you know, never letting it come into fruition and, you know, die filled with regrets. So baby steps, a baby step a day.
I like the baby steps. And I want to go back again to something that I was listening to a podcast sometime about a guy who he was talking about scheduling his day. And one of the things he did was schedule an hour every day for creativity, where there was no phone calls allowed, no emails, no one was to talk to him. He used to just find a place and he used to just really dream about things. He said it just gave him that space instead of always doing, and he usually came up with some really good ideas.
Yeah, exactly. I think if you can do it, it's great. The other learning I've had, and this is a one that my boss at a conference I was at a couple of weeks ago was talking about this, which was around living with ambiguity. So also sort of expect the unexpected. So often in the workplace, you know, something happens that day and your diary is just thrown on its head and you've got to reprioritize, or, you know, an emergency crops up, or, you know, a different customer need crops up, or something happens. Same can be at home. You know, something happens in the day, one of the kids has an accident, or, you know, something might happen that throws your day a little bit topsy-turvy. Allowing that to be okay, you know, if your day is thrown out and your schedule's thrown out of the park, not to stress too much about it, to just let what will be, and to learn to live a little bit with ambiguity and not get too uptight about it, because life brings you all kinds of weird, unexpected things, and got to just sort of let things roll sometimes. So, yeah, try and be kind to yourself if things turn on their head and figure it out later.
Have you got another poem that you can share, please?
I do have another poem. We were chatting earlier around just objects that are, you know, things that people will just walk past and overlook, or might think is a not particularly nice object or whatever. So I might do one about a worm, if that's okay. I know it's a bit random, but you did ask what kind of things give me inspiration. So I was inspired one day by a worm. And this is called Don't Look Back. Girls from my hood were often misunderstood, facing scorn since being born under a rock, where others were airlifted out to flock in manicured gardens of posh estates behind electric gates with private number plates in their drives. The rest of us were abandoned beneath the shadow of a gravestone in the belly of the council drop zone, every possession on subsidised loan, inner confidence homegrown. Buried under damp earth, the tough got tougher and the rough got rougher. Decapitate the head of a worm and it regenerates, degenerates. Nobody looked back for fear of seeing an amputated tail leaving guilt in its lifeless trail, and PTSD at being the half that survived a nail in the coffin. We were the ones that got away, rolling in the hay where a 10-pence cigarette went far, feasting on one puff before passing on the tar, sipping a bottle of scrumpy shared with Jack. We knew how to make fish and bread feed the pack of the 5,000. Survival stems from wriggling together in the dirt under the turf, where every kid on the block knew your name, and while some used it to maim, the rest wrapped around each other to foster hope, not blame. Eventually, we grew into snakes, shedding our hand-me-down school uniforms, developing a thick new skin for work, with soiled palms and calloused fingers coiled around unionised wage. Even if we wasted our hard-earned lolly, injecting venom on a weekend jolly, you could always take a loan from your bestie who never doubted the IOU because it was always paid back, gift-wrapped in loyalty. When life was too much, we stuck together like glue, retreating to the clue, tunnelling deep underground, churning, yearning for the table, turning for the blue-collar crew. We were the wormhole generation, mixing poverty with topsoil, our secretion generating enough nitrogen for new flowers to seed fresh pollen. I don't look back in anger. I languor in a place where the nutrient of life has formed, where the worm is reformed and transformed into a woman transported from the hood using poetry to be understood.
You could delve into a lot of things there.
Yeah, it's definitely an example of picking, just a random object, you know, and creating something out of it.
And it took you back to your childhood and Newcastle. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Does it take you long to write?
Poems, I would say poems, no. The first draft, no. I tend to find a creative thread, if you like, and something will come out. A longer one, that's probably a mid-length one. I've done much longer ones, the TED Talk one being an example, obviously something like the 12-minute, you know, the 12-minute TED poetry was longer, but not really. I churn them out, but it takes me much longer to edit them and to polish them and to get the sort of tone right in the spacing and everything on the page if I'm doing a written piece than it does to write the piece in the first place, which just comes out of something creative and out of comes usually in one almighty, you know, go, and then I fix it up later.
Yeah, it's definitely a real talent. While we're on the topic of your poems, your first poetry book has a great name. Can you tell me about that one?
Yeah, so the book, my debut book that came out in 2019 is called Graffiti Lane, which again, you know, it goes back to the, you know, childhood upbringing in the council estate of Newcastle and a love that I've developed for amazingly talented street artists who often make incredible artworks in and around, you know, the cities and streets. I don't mean vandalism, I mean street art, but I love it. So, yeah, I used a lot of, you know, graffiti themes in this book, which it's an art form in its own right. And it went crazy. That was just the catalyst of sort of cutting over from, you know, doing this in my spare time at night to make myself overcome insomnia to becoming a published author. And it went nuts. It became a number one bestseller. It got given in the swag bags in Hollywood to the Oscars nominees and Academy Award winners. Mm. A copy got left on Robert De Niro's bedside table. And I got to give John Travolta a copy backstage at a VIP event. And all kinds of crazy things have happened in and around this book, which I'm incredibly thrilled about. So, yeah, that was the very first one. Yeah.
Where can people learn more about you?
You can find most links to most things about me through my website, which is just www.kellyvannelson.com. And the TED Talks on there, the books links are on there, you know, to the various books and lots of stuff around, you know, social justice and helping people from underprivileged backgrounds and all the kind of things that I try to get up to in the spare time that I don't have. But yeah, you can find me on my website.
But they won't find anything about the defence work that you're doing at the moment.
No, they won't. I am doing a little discreet piece of work in UK armed forces and the defence industry, which is particularly important for the UK. And obviously I'm from here, so I'm pretty proud to be playing my part and trying to help out on the work I'm doing, but there is nothing about that on my website and I doubt there will ever be. So, yeah.
I'm joking with you. Kelly, I know who I'd like to have dinner with if that person was still alive and why I would like. Who would you like to have dinner with and why?
I might cite someone that I have had dinner with once before and I would like to have dinner with her again. Perhaps. So I had dinner years and years and years ago with Dame Stella Remington, and she is the former director of MI5 in the UK. She was the first female director of MI5, and at a business dinner, it was actually my very last business dinner in the UK before I moved to South Africa with my husband, and then after that we moved to Australia, so it was almost my leaving corporate dinner. And it was, you know, sort of a big networking event. And I was at the top table with my boss who owned the company at the time. And I was seated next to Dame Stella Remington, who was the keynote speaker. And she was super inspirational and fascinating. We actually had, I can't say I had everything in common with her, but we had some synergy. She had two children that she was balancing working at a, you know, in the top job at MI5. And she had two kids at home. you know, she had neighbours who had no clue what she did. You know, she's a public servant, by all accounts, and living this, you know, sort of life that was, you know, quite different from the perception. And she just taught me so much. I got a signed copy of her book, which was a departing gift for moving to South Africa, which said, "You only live twice," which she signed off to Sean, my husband. And I got a lot of inspiration around being able to have a career and kids and, you know, quite a senior career that can, you know, be in quite pressurized environments, getting on with that, finding ways to have the two things meet somewhere in the middle in a very balanced way. So I would love to have dinner with her again, because I learned such a lot at that short dinner to just to almost everything we've talked about today. That's why I'm thinking about her now, because she definitely was one of the people who made me think, okay, you can be a mum and you can work in the corporate world and it's okay.
You absolutely amaze me. You have such a presence about you. You're a very kind person. You work very hard. I love your family. I've got to know them over the years and they're gorgeous kids, and Sean's really handsome.
Yeah, likes to work.
And you have a beautiful home in Sydney, and there's nothing not to like about you. And I feel so lucky that by chance we met. And I can't wait till you come home. And anyway, for now, enjoy the last 2 months of this secondment in the UK. And thank you for sharing your time. I'll put all the links in the show notes and in the description of the podcast so people can find you and learn more about your crazy but brilliant career. And cheerio.
Thank you. And let's book in dinner. See you soon.
Awesome. Bye.
Bye.
Wow, how was that for insight into the extraordinary balancing act of Kelly Van Nelson, exploring the intricate dance of creativity, leadership, and family. From her roots in Newcastle upon Tyne to the nuanced moves she's made throughout her life, Kelly's journey is a testament to resilience and artful navigation. As we wrap up, take a moment to reflect on the insights and wisdom shared and click on the link in the description and tell us your thoughts. Until next time, keep balancing, keep creating, and keep listening. Cheers.
Thank you for tuning in to Sharing Stories, Changing Lives. We'd like to invite you to support us by purchasing a Backstage Pass, costing about the same as 2 cups of coffee each month. With the Backstage Pass, you'll gain access to workshops and exclusive content, including videos from our live events. You can do this by visiting our website at www.thestoryroom.au. We can continue to show that sharing stories changes lives.